Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Hey, how was your day today? Did you get a lot done? You feeling productive? I hope so. We'll tell you why in just a couple of minutes. Also, from our live road shows, actor Hank Azaria from The Simpsons. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Thursday today, the 6th of November. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. There will be time enough in the days and weeks to come to dissect what Tuesday's big night for Republicans might mean economy-wise, and we will do that, rest assured. But let us pause today, then, for some actual economic news from which some insights might be drawn. Worker productivity for the third quarter came out this morning, up 2% over the prior period, which is good, but in an economy with a sort of stuck labor market, how good exactly can it be? From Washington Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
For 3 years or so, productivity has hardly grown, about 1% or so. So today's 2 is encouraging. It's not the surge we saw in the late 90s or the early 2000s, but a hopeful sign. Economist Harry Holzer at Georgetown says the other good part is it's not just bosses cracking whips on the backs of a couple workers.
Sometimes employers raise productivity simply by squeezing more output out of fewer workers. It doesn't look like that's happening now because we know the employment numbers are growing.
Employment is up and so are wages. So part of the pie is going to workers and part to company profits and investors. Now, zooming back, workers' share of the fruits has been relatively low for decades. Many say the fates of companies and employees have decoupled. So are they recoupling? Here's economist Gary Burtless of the Brookings Institution.
Just like a snowflake doesn't bring Christmas, seeing one quarter of pretty good wage gains is not a signal that those wage gains are going to continue forever.
And any gains are not shared evenly. To some degree, productivity is about machines. Are you getting replaced by a more efficient machine, or are you designing the next one? A shakeout is underway, says MIT business professor Eric Brynjolfsson. His book is The Second Machine Age.
There are more high-skilled workers versus less-skilled workers. There are capital owners and employers versus labor. And there are superstars versus everyone else. In each case, the first group recently has been doing quite well.
The second? Not so much. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Jobs Day tomorrow, by the way. The October jobs report gets released 8:30 a.m. Washington time. From Microsoft World Headquarters in Redmond, Washington State, today came something of a seismic shift. The world's biggest software company announced what amounts to a giveaway. You are now going to be able to create and edit Office documents, Word and PowerPoint and all the rest, on your phone or on your tablet. And for nothing. Microsoft has resisted giving stuff away for years now, but tech industry trends did kind of force its hand. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganza reports.
Microsoft is jumping on the freemium bandwagon, adopting a strategy companies like LinkedIn have been using for ages, giving stuff away for free to get more users, then charging a premium for extras. Jeff Howe heads the Media Innovation Program at Northeastern University.
There's a recognition that, like, better to get everyone in the tent and then later you can figure out how to make money off of them.
In the past, you had to subscribe to Office 365 if you wanted to do anything other than read your documents on your mobile device. Now the free Microsoft app will allow you to change Office documents on your iPhone or iPad or write new ones. The version for Android tablets will be available early next year. If you want to get fancy with, say, advanced editing, then you have to pay. Why is Microsoft doing this?
Well, you know, the world has changed.
Michael Atala is director of product management at Microsoft.
People expect to be able to use their favorite apps on their favorite device wherever they are, and we're enabling that.
Another big reason for this enabling? Competition from Google Docs and other free software for document writing. Microsoft had to find a way to hang on to Office users, says Frank Gillette, industry analyst at Forrester Research.
This will help Microsoft maintain its customer relationships and reduce the likelihood that existing customers will try to move to Google Docs.
At least that's what Microsoft hopes. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
New record highs at the corner of Wall Street and Broad today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. University of California proposed a tuition increase today, a 5% hike every year for the next 5 years. The increase still does have to be approved by the university's Board of Regents, but UC President Janet Napolitano said she basically has to do it to make up for cuts in state funding. It is worth a note here that inflation in this economy right now stands at 1.7% every year. Those rising costs and student debt loads doing the same thing have a lot of people questioning the value of a college degree. Parents want to know before they pony up what schools are doing to get their kids lined up for careers. And that, in turn, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports from the Education Desk, is bringing new attention to what has traditionally been one of the least prominent fixtures on college campuses, the Career Center.
At Washington College on Maryland's Eastern Shore, most students never visited the Career Center until that senior year, I'd better start looking for a job freakout. And when they did go looking for it, it wasn't easy to find.
We have traditionally hidden our career services operation in the ground floor of a residence hall across the street from the main campus.
That's Joe Holt, chief of staff at the small liberal arts school.
You needed a fob to get admitted to the building. It wasn't very welcoming and inviting. It certainly wasn't on the admissions tour.
But when prospective students and parents visit now, they want to see it. They want to know what the college is doing to help students get internships and land jobs after graduation. Come January, Holt will have something to show them, a new million-dollar career center in a converted boiler house.
So this will be the new center.
The new center will have a comfy lounge, rooms with built-in cameras so students can watch how they do in mock interviews, and it'll be right in the heart of campus.
Now you just have to stop in on the way to class, and it also sends a powerful message to prospective students about the value we place on this by giving such important real estate to this function.
The pressure on colleges isn't just coming from students and parents. The Obama administration is working on plans for a college rating system. It's expected to factor in things like employment and student loan repayment rates. Edwin Koch is director of research at the National Association of Colleges and Employers. He says most colleges just haven't invested enough in career services. The typical career counselor serves 1,500 students.
They toil away with extremely limited resources. And so the students don't see the Career Center as central to being successful at the school. Basically, for a lot of students, the Career Center becomes an afterthought.
Even if most colleges can't afford a sparkly new building, more are working to change what goes on inside. In an old brick house at Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, senior Sean Bell McDermott climbs the creaky stairs for an advising session.
Come on in.
3 years ago, F&M transformed its traditional career center into an office of student and postgraduate development. Along with the usual coaching on resume writing and interviewing, the office does workshops on financial literacy, business etiquette, and other life skills. And every student is assigned a student development advisor starting freshman year. Today, McDermott talks with her advisor, Lori Clark, about how to network with alumni.
Once you actually get them on the phone, what do you think will be some of the things that you would ask about?
I always ask them, like, what their major was and how it led them to where they are now. They always kind of laugh. They're like, oh, back in the day. And I'm like, oh, yeah, okay.
McDermott has a ready answer because she's met with Clark at least a dozen times. She's already done two internships, one through an alumni connection. McDermott doesn't seem at all nervous about graduating into a still shaky job market.
You also know that it doesn't end when you graduate. And so it's not just, you know, the next year, the next 5 years, it's the next 20 years. I can come back here and keep using their resources.
Beth Throne led the overhaul at Franklin and Marshall. Before, she says, just 20% of students interacted with the Career Center, mostly seniors. Last year, almost 75% went to a workshop, checked in online, or met with an advisor.
When students have interacted with us over the years, they're going to be clearer about what they want to do after college. They will leave with connections who will be there to mentor them long after they graduate.
And how are students faring after graduation? Throne says nearly 80% of the class of 2014 has landed in jobs or grad school less than 6 months out. It's hard to say if that's an improvement because the college didn't really track that kind of data until now. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Facebook founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg and his wife pledged $25 million last month to help fight Ebola. And it seems that was just the start. Zuckerberg is now offering something potentially even more valuable. Facebook is rolling out a plan to put an Ebola fundraising pitch at the top of the news feeds for Facebook users in more than 30 countries. The money raised will go to three groups working in West Africa: the Red Cross, International Medical Corps, and Save the Children. From the Health Desk at WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports on this intersection of tech philanthropy and public health.
Helping stop Ebola in its tracks is clearly a philanthropic act, says Facebook executive Naomi Gleit. But really, she says, the company's mission is to make the world more open and connected.
And when the world is more open and connected, together we can do really great things.
Facebook hopes its campaign will jumpstart a wave of philanthropic giving that's been slow coming. After the Haitian earthquake, for example, the International Medical Corps received more than 8,000 donations. For Ebola, it's been a tenth of that. Yale's Nicholas Christakis sees two reasons why Facebook's campaign may work.
They have the scale, which is enormous, you know, countless millions, but also they have this ability to use peer effects to magnify the impact. Because, of course, you're more likely to respond to something if your friends have also responded to it.
The World Health Organization says containing the virus will require $1 billion, as well as hundreds of healthcare worker volunteers. It's clear Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg has taken that challenge to heart, says USC's Jim Ferris.
It's what I would call all-in philanthropy and really being out there entrepreneurial. It's not just writing a check.
Ferris runs the Center on Philanthropy and Public Policy at USC. He says Zuckerberg's entrepreneurial approach is part of a new trend where individual donors and foundations throw themselves into their own causes. Given the scale of the threat in West Africa, it might be good that one of the world's richest people is locked in. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up, the voice of half of Springfield talks about the job he's had for 25 years.
I can actually use that mimicry and silly sense of humor and doing voices in my work.
Hank Azaria from The Simpsons.
But first, let's do the numbers.
That was Mo, by the way, right? Come on, you guys knew that? Green arrows all the way around this Thursday. The Dow Industrial is up 69 points, 0.4%, closed at 17,554. The NASDAQ up 17 points, nearly 0.4%, finished at 4,638. The S&P 500 up 7 points, more than a 3%, 2,031. Record highs, as I said, for the Dow and the S&P, by the by. Investors seem to like Microsoft's new strategy we heard a bit about earlier. Shares in the tech giant traded up 1.75% today. Tesla Motors' quarterly loss was twice as big as a year ago, but it said that was because of rising demand, so good problem to have. Tesla's shares buzzed up more than 4% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.39%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on the employment situation for October. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to release consumer credit data for September. And Twitter stock began trading publicly a year ago. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
There are about 2.5 million veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Post-9/11 veterans is the phrase you hear a whole bunch. They have survived, they've come home, and most have gotten out of the service, which is, for some of them, where their problems started. Tens of thousands of soldiers have been discharged from the Army since 2001 with classifications that can mean they are not eligible for veterans benefits, valuable and expensive benefits. The Army does have a process that veterans can use to appeal to change their military records, but Alyssa Figueroa from Fusion reports that things rarely work out in their favor.
Chuck Luther went to war in 2006. 2 months into his deployment in Iraq, an IED killed 4 men in his unit. Soon after, a mortar blast left him partially deaf. Luther started to unravel.
I couldn't control my emotions. I would get upset, I would get angry, I would get mad. I felt like everybody was out to get me.
That's when, he says, the real battle began, this time with the Army. Luther was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, but it was soon changed to a personality disorder, which the Army said was pre-existing. He was kicked out of the military without benefits. Luther applied to overturn his discharge, seeking medical coverage for combat-related PTSD. The only place he could do that was the Board for Correction of Military Records. He says the Army seemed determined to deny him.
That doesn't work. It's broken. It's already a rigged system.
The board's mandate is to correct errors or injustices on a veteran's record. Sarah Burkaw is the director.
We can look at an unintended consequence of something the Army is doing and try to correct that.
But lawyers who bring these appeals, like Raymond Tony, say that rarely happens when the change could cost the Army money.
If granting an application would require the Army to pay somebody, for example, a lot of back pay or disability retirement pay, that's a strike against the applicant.
A really big strike. Fusion reviewed thousands of decisions from 2001 to 2012 where veterans appealed discharges similar to Chuck Luther's. About 2% were granted a medical evaluation that could result in getting benefits from the Army. Burkaw says the Army considers these kinds of requests carefully.
We take a lot of time to look at the evidence that's provided. We look at each case on its individual merit.
But some lawyers don't agree.
The boards do not fairly consider the cases that are before them.
Tom Moore is an attorney with the National Veterans Legal Services Program. He says his team of pro bono lawyers bring strong cases that are almost summarily denied by the board.
The system's not designed to fix these problems.
The board is composed of a panel of three senior-level civilian employees of the Army. Moore says they're chosen because they're highly respected and competent.
I'm sure many of them are well-meaning and capable of making good decisions, but the system does not allow them to do that because there's an impetus to push these cases through quickly.
Congress mandates the board decide all cases within a year and a half, so each meeting lasts about 5 hours, and board members decide about 80 cases. That's an average of less than 4 minutes per application, even though some, like Chuck Luther's, are hundreds of pages long. Board members are given a case summary and a recommended decision by an Army analyst who's reviewed the application.
You know, for the board to really work, you have to be able to force the board members to consider the applications, to consider the facts, all the pertinent records.
The board's decisions can be challenged in federal court, but lawyer Raymond Tony estimates that happens about 1% of the time.
In part because it's very expensive and it's a very daunting undertaking, frankly.
Burkaw says the board does the best it can with the resources it has.
We want to get it right. Above all else, we want to make sure that we give these soldiers, veterans, and their family members the best opportunity to get that justice that they're looking for, and to also make sure that our Army records are as correct as they possibly can.
Chuck Luther doesn't think they got it right by him. He was denied by the Board for Correction of Military Records twice, even though he believed he had a strong case.
You don't expect the very agency that wronged you the first time to admit that they wronged you and fix it.
Luther's given up fighting his case. Today he works with soldiers at Fort Hood, trying to resolve issues before they end in a bad discharge. I'm Alyssa Figueroa for Marketplace.
Alyssa's story was produced for us by Fusion. That's a partnership of ABC News and Univision. You can find a link at marketplace.org. We've been out on the road this year with a live show that we called How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Numbers, a celebration of sorts to mark the 25 years that we have been on the air. 1989, it turns out, was the beginning of a whole lot of things. Microsoft Word, which we talked about earlier in the show. Also, The Simpsons. December the 17th, 1989 was its premiere. And 554 episodes later, if you want to keep on thinking about the numbers, you might recognize our next guest by the Simpsons characters that he provides the voice for. Mo the Bartender, Chief Wiggum, Apu, to name just a couple. And I'll tell you what, this doesn't happen much, but when I brought Hank Azaria out onto the stage of the 92nd Street Y, people in the audience actually screamed. Well, it was one lady, and she said, "Oh my God!" So here you go. Oh my God! It's you!
Was the oh my God for Mo?
For Mo.
That's all I want to know.
Do you know, I'm sure you do, The number of characters you've done on The Simpsons?
No, I don't know exactly. I know that the key number really is around 30. Those are the ones that will come up consistently and be on any given episode. But over the years, if you count characters who've appeared once or done a few lines, way over 100.
You decided it not too long, well, a while ago, actually, you couldn't do anymore, right? You were basically done with the new characters?
I didn't decide it. I just got tapped out. Yeah, like for the first 10 or 15 years of the show, any new character, I had a new voice ready. And then I noticed a few years ago, I don't have any more.
You got nothing left?
No, I don't have any. Anything new I created sounded too similar to something I've already done.
When did you realize that this ability you had was a marketable skill? Was a thing you could make money on?
Make money on? Not until close to when I actually started doing The Simpsons. I grew up imitating everything and mimicking everything I heard on TV and everywhere. And sort of separately from that, got interested in acting at age 16. I was sort of a class clown. And then it wasn't even until I was about 5 years into studying acting that I realized, wait a minute, I can actually use that mimicry and silly sense of humor and doing voices in my work. It didn't occur to me.
And do I have it right that you went in and you read for some character on The Simpsons and they said, yeah, you're hired. Come on over. Can you do this now for the show this afternoon?
Yeah. The first character I read for was Mo, the bartender. I was doing a play in L.A. at the time where I was playing a drug dealer, and I was doing a bad impression of Al Pacino from Dog Day Afternoon.
Yeah, yeah.
Al was a lot higher then, you know, his vocal register. I'm dying here. Everybody's coming down on me. And I did that, and they said, well, he needs to be gravelly. Can you make the voice gravelly? So if you take Al Pacino from Dog Day Afternoon and you add gravel, you get Mo. They were unamused, but they're like, no, sounds fine. Come come record it.
You are in a business that is almost entirely dependent on numbers, right? Both the financing of it, which we were talking about backstage, but also the ratings, right? I mean, you were in a series on Showtime, Huff, a long time ago now, actually, which lasted 2 seasons. Mm-hmm. But those are numbers you don't have a whole lot of control over. How do you learn to stop worrying about that?
That takes a long time. It only happened about 20 minutes ago for me. But if you're lucky enough to have a long career, I think just with age you realize that, well, there were 20 times in my life I flipped out in fear. There were 20 times I was sure I had it made. None of those worked out the way I thought. So a career does that, you realize, and you might as well just take it easy because, you know, it's a marathon, not a sprint.
You did commercial voiceover work for a while, too.
For a little while.
A little while, and then in the end it kind of didn't work out.
I didn't enjoy it, no.
Yeah.
The last audition I had for a commercial, Jell-O was doing a campaign. They wanted the voice of Jell-O Man, which was a computer-animated Jell-O-O that lived in your refrigerator. And you'd open the door and he would monologue at you. And I figured, well, he's a vagrant, so... I did a voice like this, like, how you doing? I'm Jell-O Man, how are you? And I did the... It was a long monologue. And the casting director gave me a long lot of notes. Like, well, she said, you know, we want Jell-O Man to have an edge, but... That's a big catchphrase, is an edge. But they have to be likable. That's the other catchphrase. But we don't want him to frighten the children. I swear to God, that's what she said to me. As she was talking, I realized I'm never going to audition for another commercial again. And this is my last one, and I'm going to go out with a bang. And I really did. And she finished talking, and I said, you do realize Jell-O Man's not real, don't you? And I left, and that was it. And I never went back into another commercial room. That was it for me.
That's a good one. I promised myself I wasn't going to do this, but now that I have you here, I need you to do Mo saying, but first, let's do the numbers.
That's a weird request, but...
I know.
But first, let's do the numbers.
Hank Azaria, ladies and gentlemen. We are on stage again for the last time this year. Anyway, this coming weekend, right here in L.A., Saturday night, Amy Poehler, Norman Lear, Gwen Shotwell. She is the president of SpaceX, and Franklin Leonard, he's the guy who founded the Blacklist. Get your tickets while you still can. They're going fast. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, in which I think humanity finally takes leave of its senses. The Discovery Channel is going to start a new series next month called Eaten Alive. On the premiere episode, a guy will be shown being swallowed alive by a giant snake, an anaconda in point of fact, after covering himself in pig's blood while wearing a custom-built suit. A promo of the show shows said guy saying, "You have to go in head first." So, you decide. Animal abuse? Criminal stupidity? Yeah. What do you do with that? All right, we're done. That's it. That's Marketplace from APM. Today is Thursday. The Dow Industrials up 69 points today, 0.4%. The NASDAQ up 17 points, nearly 0.4%. The S&P 500 put on 7 points, more than a third of 1%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our brand spanking new managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.